John Helton with American Banker. So Dan Turullo, about a month ago, fielded a question of why not just have more capital, and then instead of having this whole Rube Goldberg machine, as you put it. And his response was that the very nature of capital is that in a crisis it gets absorbed, right? I mean, that's the whole shock absorbing, you know, feature of it. And his, I'm paraphrasing, but the thrust of it was, you know, the very nature of capital is that eventually you don't have it anymore. And so that you need to have some sort of mechanisms in place for resolution should that event happen. It's a kind of a broad question, but so is that a concern of yours that putting so much additional capital as the sort of one and only mechanism for preventing crises or absorbing crises, is that short-sighted?
Sure. Well, we, and if you look in our summary, we actually addressed that in one of the later questions. So let me say it another way. Some regulators say they want to have this layer of debt. So once all the equity is wiped out, they put the bank into resolution, they can then convert this debt to equity, and that debt is a source of funds for recapitalization. That's not an argument actually in favor of debt. That's an argument of seizing the bank before all the capital is wiped out. You can have just as much loss absorption if you have all equity instead of equity and debt if you just seize the bank earlier. And that's what we ought to do. And that's what we would be in favor of as part of the Minneapolis plan to address Governor Trullo's concerns.
I'm just wondering if you would be able to say anything that you see on the horizon, either now or in the future, that would have you think that it's not a good idea to go ahead with the December rate hike, please.
Well, I've made a personal policy of not predicting when our rate hikes are going to be. We're going to look at the data. I've also said that I'm looking at core inflation. I'm looking at inflation expectations, and I'm looking at the headline unemployment rate. And I want to see movement across one or more of those measurements before I reach my conclusion about December.
Okay. Hey, Neil. So if your chances of getting Congress to move on this were low before, what are they now? I mean, how do you think the election impacts your proposal? Especially because it's maybe a little unclear where the new administration stands. Like, on the one hand, there's a lot of anti-Wall Street sentiment, but on the other hand, there's been talk about just completely getting rid of Dodd-Frank. So,
yeah, the truth is I don't know either. I don't know what the current political environment means in terms of the prospects for this plan. You know, we're not a political organization. Our jobs are to identify risks that we see, put out analysis, put out a set of options, and let Congress and the public react to them. And I hope they'll give this serious consideration. But I don't know. I can't forecast it.
Has anyone in the Trump transition team reached out to you or, you know, post-election or even pre-election the Trump campaign to get your thoughts?
No. I had no contact with the Trump campaign or transition team.
I've heard, sorry, but I can ask another question. But I've heard early kind of reaction to the plan that it may actually overestimate the costs in terms of economic growth. I guess the theory being that if you have a financial sector that is seen as more stable, banks that are seen as more possible to be resolved, that would actually create a certain kind of confidence in the financial sector. Are these estimates conservative?
Well, I'm happy to hear that. In our judgment, these estimates were meant to be conservative. We felt like we were generous in how much capital we attributed is in the system today. So that 13% number, I think some people would argue, is too high. But we wanted to be generous to the current regime, and we wanted to be conservative in our estimates of costs. You know, some people have said, no, there's no cost to increasing capital requirements. We didn't buy that. So we said, no, we're going to try to be conservative in our models. And this is the type of feedback we're excited to get from experts who say, no, maybe you're too conservative here or there. We're open-minded to hearing that.
Could you talk more about the decision to have the certification come from the Treasury? What were alternatives that you considered, or are there other ones that you'd be willing to consider?
Well, the alternatives that we thought about were the Financial Stability Oversight Council, which has a role today in designating firms being systemically important. or also the Federal Reserve. And this was just a judgment call that Congress could decide to go in a different direction and be very reasonable in making a different, drawing a different conclusion. My view was having one person accountable be the decision maker is more practical than getting a whole handful of regulators to agree. And that's why we said there should be one unique person to do that. And we felt the Treasury Secretary was the best equipped. Number one, he currently chairs the FSOC, so there's that connectivity. Number two, there's a direct line of accountability between the Treasury Secretary to the President and ultimately to the Congress. The Congress holds the executive branch accountable. That felt right, but at the end of the day, it's Congress's call.
Why would you not consider the FDIC? I mean, they have institutional history and knowledge resolution.
I think we could look at that. These are big calls that are important calls being made about whether or not the biggest financial institutions in America are too big to fail or not. It felt like something that would rise to the level of the Treasury Secretary to make that determination. But I think reasonable people could draw different conclusions.
Mark Chong, CNBC. How do you think the President-elect will react to the Minneapolis plan, and how will the President work with the Fed to implement it?
The truth is, I don't know. I haven't had any contact with the transition team or the President-elect. I'm hopeful people on both sides of the aisle who care about the issue of too big to fail and care about financial stability will give this serious consideration. And we are available and happy to meet with anybody from any political party who cares about this issue and wants to discuss it with us.
Matthew Vosa with Bloomberg. So you talk about how this is a choice for the voters. You've been speaking to a lot of voters in your new role over the last year. What's the sense you get from them? What's your view of their opinion of this?
I think intuitively most people that I've met with intuitively believe the biggest banks are still too big to fail. They know that the biggest banks are bigger than they were before the financial crisis, and intuitively they think that's not right. And then I think when they look at the numbers and say, well, there was an 84% chance of a crisis, now it's 67%, I think they're going to say, wow, that's not as much safety as we thought we had achieved in the last 8 years. So I think that's going to be a very powerful fact for people to consider. And then I believe they're going to say, yeah, we do think we want to go forward. And that's where understanding the cost is very important.
I'm just full of questions here. So this has been a pretty big year for you. It's a big project to undertake and to complete. What are you doing next year?
Well, we'll see. Wide open as to, first of all, this, we're not done. We want to continue working on this issue and engage with people who are interested in it. And then, you know, there are a lot of big policy challenges we face as a country. I'm working with our experts at the Minneapolis Fed to figure out what are the policy issues we can make the biggest contribution to. And that's what I want us to go tackle.
I mean, I guess you said you don't plan to lobby for this, you don't plan to kind of push it. Is the idea just to kind of put this out there and let it float, or do you want to kind of stay engaged on this topic?
I definitely want to stay engaged on this topic, and again, our next steps will in part depend how people receive this. Is there receptivity? Are people interested in this? Do people say, hey, let's look at another way of calculating the cost? There may be follow-on analyses that come from this, so we're open-minded about that. So this will be a continuation, and then other topics that I've talked about which are important to me are issues like economic disparity. It's around the country, and even within the 9th District, there are big gaps in different racial groups, different demographic groups, and there's not enough analysis understanding the sources of those gaps. So that's something we at the Minneapolis Fed and others are looking at, trying to see, can we analyze this? Can we understand it? Even if monetary policy can't solve it, if we can help understand it and analyze it, then we could be making a contribution.
Your plan, if it went to effect, it would have long-term rewards, which is not something that I think the American country is known for looking at or wanting. How do you sell people on long-term rewards?
Well, that's why moving now is so important, because most people still remember how bad the crisis was. And as that elapses in our minds, they're going to forget about, we all do, it's human nature, forget about how bad the crisis was. Then it becomes much, much harder to say we want to avoid a repeat of that thing that happened 20 or 30 years ago. So that's why we have to strike, so to speak, while the iron is hot, while it's so fresh in our memories, and people still feel motivation to want to do something about it.
One of the things you said that I thought was kind of interesting was how you think the polarization of our country now stems a lot from financial crisis what? How does that appear to you?
It appears to me, honestly, I kind of take some responsibility. I feel like the bailouts violated a core belief that's been handed down from generation to generation in our society. That belief is, if you take a risk, you bear the rewards and the consequences of that risk. Well, we had to tear that up in the crisis because the biggest banks were going to fail and bring down the whole U.S. economy. And when you violate the core beliefs of a society, it does lead to great anger and a feeling of, hey, this wasn't fair. This wasn't the deal that we all agreed as a nation. And I believe, and I may be too close to the financial crisis, so I look at things through that lens, but I believe the polarization that we see today is a direct result of that.
You also mentioned something about how the downturn in housing became this great crisis because the banks didn't have enough capital. What about, because it strikes me, the reason the housing downturn became a great recession is not because of housing. We could have gotten through with some kind of slowdown, maybe even not a recession. It was because all those loans, all those mortgages have been packaged and repackaged into securities that the banks who owned them didn't even understand. They didn't assess the risk, and when those blew up, and it wasn't trading corporate bonds, right, the Volcker Rule, that was pretty safe. Those desks have to mark to market every day. That's the stuff that turned it into the worst recession since the Great Depression. How does your plan deal with that?
Well, I think they're both true. And if, so I'm starting from the assumption that regulators and bankers in the future are going to make big mistakes again. And so they made big mistakes in how they packaged and priced and understood those mortgage-backed securities. If they had more capital, they could still make that mistake and not bring the whole system down. So, I mean, I would like to design a system where they don't make the mistakes, but let's just start with assuming that they will. And that's why capital is so important. The other thing is, if the banks had a lot more capital, let's say starting in 2000, there's a decent chance that the housing bubble would have been not quite as extreme. So then the housing downturn, if it didn't inflate quite as much because the banks were not so highly levered, then it wouldn't have as far to fall, and maybe the whole hit on the U.S. economy broadly would have been far less. And so more capital can actually help from multiple dimensions.
Would you do more to change the way derivatives are sold, packaged, traded?
Well, I think some good has been done there. I haven't looked recently as to say, is it enough? Do we need to go further? But more transparency is clearly a good thing. Helping people understand what they're buying, understanding what risks, I mean, that's clearly important. And I know I'm repeating myself, but I start with the assumption of we have to assume that people are going to make mistakes in the future, assume they're going to misprice things in the future. Let's just have a financial system that can withstand those mistakes.
One more question.
Yeah, can you talk more about the community banking part of your plan? So if I understand it correctly, you essentially want a new regulatory agency for smaller...
Not necessarily a new agency, but just a new... For example, the capital requirements that we're talking about would not apply to the community banks. We think that those should be redone, lower levels. Right now, I hear every day from community banks that have to spend a lot of money on compliance on things that are not directly related to whether they're safe and sound. Right? They're having to chase a lot of shadows because of actions of the big banks. So if we relax some of those minutia requirements on the community banks, just focus on lower but simple capital requirements, that's a much better way to regulate community banks.
Could you give an example of what kind of minutia you're talking about? So for example, I've read a lot of material loss reports from the past financial crisis. I mean, some of the worst actors in the financial crisis were community bankers, whether they admit it or not. So, sure. I mean, are you talking about, you know, consumer regulation?
No, I'm talking about things like, so you're right. Community banks, it's not good if they fail. It's not good for their community, but it doesn't bring down the whole economy. And that's why having lower standards for community banks makes sense relative to the biggest banks on Wall Street. But for example, I hear from community banks that they have regulators going, they're looking at how they're managing their vendors. Right? What does that have to do with the safety and soundness of the bank? You know, the Volcker Rule can be a burden on some community banks. You know, that's silly to apply the Volcker Rule to community banks. I think there's largely consensus that it should not apply. But as I go and talk to more and more community bankers and saying, where are you spending your time responding to regulations? A lot of the feedback I'm getting is we're responding to all of these other things that don't directly affect whether or not we are a safe and sound institution. That's where we need to focus our regulations.